Good morning. It's Friday, the 19th of April, and this is Govind Raj Ethiraj broadcasting and streaming from Mumbai, India's financial capital. Our top stories and themes for the day: the stock market struggle and give up gains in Thursday's trade as weakness continues. Crude is down below $87 a barrel. Foods company Nestle is under fire for adding sugar in 2,000 crore rupee Cerelac brand. Headcounts continue to fall in India's IT services majors amidst flat revenue growth. Can falling iPhone sales impact India's production? And elections kick off today. What's at stake in the minds of India's voters?
This is a Core Report with Govind Raj Ethiraj.
The stock markets struggle and give up gains. The stock markets put up a brave front in early trade on Thursday, but then started giving into selling pressure, as was mostly on the cards thanks to an overhang of high interest rates, funds moving back to bonds, and of course the tensions in the Middle East. The BSE Sensex closed 455 points lower at 72,489, and the Nifty, that's the NSE Nifty, closed 152 points lower at 25,996. In the broader markets, the Nifty mid-cap was also down, as was the small cap, settling lower. On the BSE, it was stocks like Bharti Airtel which led the charts, while Nestle India was amongst the major laggards, and more on Nestle in a moment. Significantly, oil prices have fallen to a shade below $87 a barrel, or about $86.90, which is a fair fall, actually, or a significant fall, at least directionally. Reuters computes that oil prices have recoiled some 6.5% from Friday's 2024 highs to levels last seen before Israel's attack on Iran's Syrian consulate on April 1st. The reason attributed to the fall in oil prices is surging U.S. crude inventories, poor economic numbers from China for March, and a U.S. warning about releasing more of its strategic petroleum reserves if necessary. Back home, results season is now underway. The automotive sector has been largely doing well, as we've been seeing in the numbers for dispatches and sales in recent quarters, and the financials are reflecting that. India's Bajaj Auto has beaten fourth quarter profit estimates on Thursday thanks to strong domestic demands for its motorcycles and a recovery in two-wheeler exports. Standalone net profit climbed about 35% to 1,936 crore rupees for the 3 months to March 31st. From a year earlier. Total income for Q4 was at about 11,900 crores, up from 9,192 crores for the same period last year. Headcount is falling for IT services majors amidst flat revenue. Bangalore-headquartered Infosys reported lower than expected fourth quarter revenue on Thursday as spending slowed in its primary client markets of North America and others. Revenue growth was up only about 1.3% on year at about 37,900 crores in the January to March quarter. For fiscal 25, Infosys has now forecast a revenue growth between 1 and 3% in constant currency, that's in US dollars. Reuters has reported that India's $254 billion IT sector has been struggling in recent quarters as clients have cut spending on non-essential projects amidst inflationary pressures that we've been talking about, particularly in the United States again. Significantly, Infosys's headcount for the financial year 2024 declined by about 26,000 people for the first time in at least 23 years since 2001. The total headcount for the year 23-24 stood at about 317,240, which is about 7.5% lower from the previous year's numbers. On a quarterly basis, too, Infosys added about 5,400 fewer employees, a drop for the fifth consecutive quarter. The attrition rate for Q4 on the last 12-month basis was down to 12.6% from about 12.9% in the previous quarter. All of this is pretty good, actually, compared to, let's say, COVID-era levels, where attrition levels were much, much higher. Infosys has been skipping going for campus hirings for at least the last four quarters, as it looks to monitor utilization rates and follow a flexi hiring model, according to Money Control. TCS, or Tata Consultancy Services, which reported Q4 earnings last week, said that its headcount had shrunk by about 13,000 employees on a year-on-year basis, a first in 19 years since it got listed in 2004. Now, while there is some switching happening between IT services companies that are more publicly scrutinized and the lower profile global capability centers or offshore centers of global multinationals, it does not appear that the numbers are really balancing out fully, as the reduction in workforce appears more of a push rather than an outcome of pull or demand from elsewhere. Now, this has other more important ramifications on overall consumption and borrowing power in this otherwise vibrant segment of young India and in cities like Bangalore, Hyderabad, and Delhi's national capital region, among others. Large pension funds like CalPERS are cutting back on equities. Elsewhere, in a fresh sign of how funds could move in coming months or year, stock portfolios at large pension funds in the United States are cashing out after a blockbuster run, the Wall Street Journal is reporting. Corporate pension funds are shifting money into bonds, while state and local government funds are swapping stocks for alternative investments. America's largest public pension, the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, a fairly active investor in Indian assets, by the way, is planning to move close to $25 billion out of equities and onto private equity and private debt. Now, there is no India equation or India linkage that I can see from this, but as a larger trend, it's an important one to note. For pension funds, which target specific investment returns to fund future obligations, this is a welcome change, apparently. It means that they can take less risk and stay on track towards those goals. While stocks have fallen recently, the S&P 500 still remains only 4.4% below its record close. The index's 10% gain through the end of March marked its best first quarter performance since 2019, and a persistently strong economy has pushed interest rates to multi-decade highs. This is all in the United States. Nestle under fire for adding sugar in its 2,000 crore rupee Cerelac brand for children. A news report in The Guardian, United Kingdom, has said that packaged goods major Nestle has added sugar and honey to its infant milk and cereal range sold in low and middle-income countries. The Guardian reported on Wednesday the findings of Public Eye, a Swiss investigative group, which said that Nestle added sugar in the form of sucrose or honey in its Nido and Cerelac range sold in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Campaigners from Public Eye, a Swiss investigative organization whose website I also went through, sent samples of the Swiss multinational's baby food products sold in Asia, Africa, and Latin America to a Belgian laboratory for testing. So why is this a problem? Well, World Health Organization guidelines for the European region say that no added sugars or sweetening agents should be permitted in any food for children under 3. While no guidance has been specifically produced for other regions, researchers say that the European document remains equally relevant to other parts of the world, according to The Guardian as well. Actually, the United Kingdom recommends that children under 4 avoid food with added sugars because of risks including weight gain and tooth decay. The United States government guidelines recommend avoiding foods and drinks with added sugars for those younger than 2. Obesity is increasingly a problem in low and middle-income countries. In Africa, the number of overweight children under 5 has increased by nearly 23% since 2000, according to the World Health Organization. And globally, more than a billion people are living with obesity. A Nestle India spokesperson responded to media saying that they believed in the nutritional quality of their products for early childhood and prioritized using high-quality ingredients. And over the past 5 years, Nestle India has reduced added sugars by up to 30% depending on the variant in their infant cereals portfolio, that's milk cereal-based complementary food. Public Eye said that in India, where sales surpassed $250 million in 2022, all Cerelac baby cereals contain added sugar, on average nearly 3 grams per serving, and the company, that's Nestle, sells 15 products under the range in this country. It does appear that Nestle, however, is disclosing the sugar levels, or at least the sugar that's present in their products, as opposed to maybe in some other countries where it may not be doing so. Nigel Rawlings, a scientist at the WHO, when presented with the findings, said that there is a double standard here that can't be justified. India's food regulator has promised an investigation into Nestle India, according to much later reports last evening. Apple's iPhone shipments fall, exploring the India impact. Apple's iPhone shipments have fallen by a worse than projected 10% in the quarter ended in March, thanks to slowing sales in China, though the overall smartphone industry has done well. Apple shipped about 50 million iPhones in the first 3 months of the year, according to market tracker IDC, falling shy of the 51.7 million average analyst estimate compiled by Bloomberg. The 9.6% year-on-year drop is the steepest for Apple since COVID lockdown snarled supply chains in 2022, the researchers said, quoted by Bloomberg. Now, the drop in iPhone shipments is actually significant because the overall mobile phone market has registered its best growth in years. Smartphone makers shipped about 290 million handsets in this period, which reflects a roughly 8% rise from the trough of a year ago when many manufacturers were grappling with a surfeit of unsold devices, said Bloomberg. Samsung has regained the top spot in the March quarter, while budget-focused Transition increased shipments by 85% and Xiaomi bounced back to close the gap on second-place Apple. Analysts like IDC are saying that as the market recovers further in 2024, Android could grow much faster than Apple. So what does falling iPhone sales mean for the overall iPhone ecosystem, including the manufacturing of it in India? I reached out to Tarun Pathak, research director at Counterpoint Research, and I began by asking him how he was seeing the fall in iPhone sales and also the overall Android to iOS ecosystem outlook for India.
There are a couple of factors that are happening. We are also, Counterpoint is also projecting a growth of somewhere close to like 5-6%. And then we have, if you look at from the Apple's point of view, it could be slightly down by 3-4%. So our numbers will be out very soon. But there are large couple of things that are happening. I think year-on-year comparison, if you look at the last year, we had you look at the 2022 when it existed, Apple had this Foxconn factory issue in China. And some of the demand was carried forward, right, in Jan, Feb, and March last year. So the base-to-base comparison was a little bit different. But largely what is happening from the global point of view is China is slowing down for Apple, one of its key markets. And the reason is of the rise of Huawei over there in the premium, because until now, since ban, not even a single OEM could give a strong competition to Apple in the premium space. And now with the Huawei coming back, things are getting a bit competitive in the premium segment over there. So those tests from the big market. North America also, like, which is one of the critical markets for Apple, remains slow in terms of upgrade, and the postpaid and prepaid, if you look at kind of offers they had, was not big enough to convert those purchases. Most of these users are holding on to their phones for a longer period of time. So that's the big market. And the third one is India. India is again slow for Apple in Q1, and a couple of reasons. In the Android side, we saw launches in the form of Galaxy S24. Obviously, it's a seasonal one because Q4 normally goes to Apple and then Q1 of the calendar year goes to Samsung in the premium space, because they normally launch. And S24 has been doing really well in terms of their Gen AI positioning and AI features and everything. So there was a bit of competitive headwinds for them, and the other bit of geopolitical, and more or less Q1 is largely a slow period as well, because everyone is coming from the festive season, holiday season sales. And those are the couple of pointers that we are seeing in our research.
If I can also link to Apple's production in India, which is increasing, is there a link between what its potential sales are and the fact that it's still ramping up production in India?
We do not see any impact over there, because if you look at right now, 70% of what Apple produces in India is meant for export. Only 30% is largely for the domestic consumption, which is like, and if you look at the countries where Apple normally supplies or exports from India, is the European market. And European markets are the markets that actually grew strongly in Q1. It's actually LATAM and Europe. So we do not see any impact over there, because the markets where Apple export are actually increasing, and hence we do not see a direct impact on the production from India. In fact, that is going to increase, because we are seeing a larger ramp up of volume from the Apple suppliers in India. Things are getting better. You have a couple of factories that are now up and running, multiple suppliers. So things are looking better from that side of things.
We keep hearing a lot of numbers about how many phones are being produced and what is the value. Is there a number that you have which is somewhat current?
So again, it ranges. Like, we saw a Bloomberg report recently which talks about a 14 billion, almost doubled year on year. We should be on the similar lines as well. Obviously, it depends because our research largely talks about the retail ASP of the devices. But largely, you can take the similar number and say, okay, there's something what Apple is doing in India, and the potential is big. Right now, it's a 13% share of the global iPhone sampling, but it could very well double in the next 3 or 4 years if everything goes well from Apple's point of view. And then obviously you have a supplier ecosystem that becoming robust year on year in India.
If I can come back to what I started with, I mean, we were looking at how Samsung has obviously grown quite smartly in this quarter and continues to be strong. What's your general sense on how people are viewing or welcoming or using Android versus Apple in a larger consumer behavior sense?
We still see a very strong stickiness for iOS ecosystem. Obviously, the upgrade rate is very, very strong. And there has been lately, we have seen Android to iOS conversion that has been happening, and that has actually increased over the past 2 years where Apple has gained share. So that trend continues. Now, the point is, which are the OEMs in the Android camp that can actually arrest that switcher data? So what is happening? We have seen Samsung doing pretty well because Samsung is the only brand in the past 2 years that has actually become a early mover in two trends. One is the foldables, and the other is the AI capabilities on the phone. And both these trends, Apple is late to the market, and Samsung knows it. So that's an area we can see developing and getting more interesting as more and more OEMs in the Android camp adopt foldables or AI features. But again, AI, I won't say Apple will be that late, because we are already hearing rumors about Apple's possible entry in the AI in smartphones later this year with the launch of new iPhones.
Tarun, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Elections start today. What's at stake? India will begin voting in general elections in a 7-phase election that starts this morning. In today's first phase of voting in 21 states and territories, as many as 102 constituencies will exercise the franchise from a total of 543 for the lower house of parliament or Lok Sabha. Results are to be declared on the 4th of June. The Election Commission has set up more than 1 million polling stations for the nearly 2-month duration of elections, with some 15 million officials and security personnel fanning out for this task as compiled by Reuters. I reached out to veteran economic journalist and columnist Shankar Iyer and a regular guest on our show for a quick status check on where voters stood in his view on economic and other issues going into elections this time. And I began by also asking him, of course, what's at stake in voters' minds?
We are at a very interesting intersection, both in global terms and in domestic terms. When we look at the global economy, the theme song of higher for longer, the IMF and World Bank meetings are being held in Washington. The concern is about deglobalization, decoupling, fragmentation, all of which impacts us. So does the higher cost of capital. Within India, also, there is a bifurcation in the economy. The South seems to be doing much better. GST data shows that consumption is higher in better developed states. The quest for welfare is higher in the northern states, which is also home to the large number of young people. If you look at demographically, India is divided. The North is still young and growing in terms of workforce. The South is aging and sort of shrinking in terms of the workforce. So India's economy is poised at an intersection where, you know, there is hope and there is also fear of uncertainty, because recent developments, disruptions, have cast a shadow over the Indian economy.
One of the things that you've written about, Shankar, and we've also talked about, is how first-time voters would look at this election. So the question, of course, is for both sets. Now, one is first-time voters, and maybe they're by extension younger voters. And secondly, voters overall, what would be the top one or two things on their mind as they decide who to vote for?
Well, for the first-time voters, Govind, the primary focus would be about job creation and growth. And when I mentioned about disruptions, so the world economy is moving from a demand-constrained situation to a supply-constrained situation, because everything is changing in technology, climate change, countries are migrating to greener economies. And so all of this means that the stability, predictability in job creation is less. As we know, this year has been the lowest placement for engineers across IT companies. Placement has been poor even in management institutes. So for the first time voters, unemployment will remain the single focus on who promises a better future for them. For the rest of the population, I think there will be a mix of emotive and rational issues, or emotive and real issues, if I may say so. The real issues are really about well-being, which is air pollution, water scarcity. Almost every city now is experiencing some form of water famine, or rather the sight of tankers, water tankers, is ubiquitous across cities. And there is also this concern about where the nation is heading in terms of its social norms, in terms of its cultural norms. India, as we know, has sort of worked around the middle path for a very long time. So in some quarters, there is a concern about extreme articulation, extreme ideas.
So would you say then that economic issues are not necessarily on the top of voters' minds as we go into elections this year?
Livelihood and lives, the sequencing is interchangeable in the Indian context, depending on where you are. If you have a job and a house and an EMI and a car, then, you know, life sort of comes up first. But if you don't have that, then livelihood comes first. So on the supply side, if you look at democracy per se, on the supply side, there are all the promises and the manifestos. And on the demand side, the expectations and the aspirations of the people. Now, who ends up where and how is really the campaign about. But I don't see much of an active competition among political parties in terms of what the road ahead is. Particularly, I mean, you know, I'm struck by the lack of articulation on how would they like to see India in terms of AI? What are the threats of climate? None of these points are not there in the campaign debates. So that's kind of sad.
So as an extension to that, would you feel that, or rather, what then are people really expecting from politicians? I mean, is there a feeling, this is both an anecdotal and an intuitive question, I guess. Are people expecting politicians to solve certain problems, or do they not even expect them to solve problems because things move in a certain linear way in India, and I'm talking about economically, and therefore politicians can do not much.
Well, now we are in the world of ChatGPT and apps and stuff. So, you know, there will be a white label app that people look at in India, look at elections in a very tactical way. So India's democracy in many ways is a benign monarchy, and we've discussed this before. And so to vote tactically, it's like installing an app on your phone. You don't really know how good that is, but you go by what the description says. At some point, you will install or uninstall the app, rate it, trash it, whatever. People expect that the app will deliver, which is the government. And they get an opportunity to course correct. The government also gets an opportunity to update the software. So democracy, if you look at it, it's an iOS system or an operating system on which various kinds of apps are sort of placed. I think the expectation is more about being heard, more about being responsive. Unfortunately, given the size of our electorate, I mean, there's over 960-970 million voters. Some of the constituencies have huge number of voters. I don't think it's humanly possible for a member of parliament to sort of hold a town hall. I would like to, I mean, you know, MPs who are getting elected to say that every time there is a bill in parliament, we would hold a small town hall and Govindathiraj would sort of moderate that discussion between the people and member of parliament. But I guess we will have to sort of dream on about that.
On that theme of dreams and elections and happy electoral outcomes, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy voting to all the folks listening to you.
That was The Core Report with me, Govindraj Ethiraj. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter for our exclusive stories, one in-depth feature a day on www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback on how we can make business more interesting and relevant, including, of course, India's vibrant manufacturing sector. So write to us at feedback@thecore.in. And thank you once again for listening.